This particular poem is fairly focused in its attack and theme. And so, at least part of the, we have fewer dramatic problems to deal with. So that we'll have more time, I hope, to talk about the implications of the text for us. And I'm curious, what images, what do you think about? What images pop into your head? What kind of definition pops into your head with the word pride?
Pride.
There's some use of the old English word haughtiness, but the
esteem.
The simple what?
Esteem.
All right. That really gets us into one of the central problems of the language. Much of the when you represent a text in another language, you have a pool of words that doesn't exactly correspond to the pool of the word shape. You have a word that doesn't exactly correspond to the word shape in the language you come out of, so that there is a whole use of the word pride which is fairly positive in its connotation, like self-esteem. We'd hardly expect a person not to have some sense of their own worth, and in fact one of the major texts have polluting shale about them. Almost every text has sort of tangent interpretations which can very much cause a lot of trouble, because a word means something and doesn't mean something else, and a lot of times we forget to say what the text doesn't mean. And so you have a lot of spin-off of texts that are so in the whole polemic against pride, of which this is a very classic statement, you have one very harmful spin-off is the way some people take pride to be an attack on self-esteem and a sense of self-worth, and so confuse an attack on a disoriented sense of the self with an attack on a healthy sense of the self. And it all hinges on the fact that pride sometimes in English idiom is part of statements about the worthwhileness of the person, and sometimes used to discriminate out in persons and in community a particular kind of consciousness which has a great many disastrous effects. So your introduction of the synonym of esteem really got us into the middle of the problem of the English word pride. Do you have any other images or kind of definitions that pop into your mind with the word pride? What do you think of when you think of pride?
I think it can be a positive rejoicing in something. You're proud of a family member who's achieved or something, you know, and that's rejoicing with that person or over that person's achievement.
All of these one would hardly expect Yahweh to be, or the prophet of Yahweh to be, complaining about.
Isn't there an arrogance and pride that they don't just want good for their own person, but they want better than the other, somebody else?
Now we're into the negative connotations of the word pride, and one of them is, what do you mean by arrogance? What's arrogance?
The feeling that I'm a little bit better than you.
And now we're better than.
You know, like everyone said, you rejoice in your child, you know, over what they have done, but you rejoice in the fact that your child is a little bit better than the guy next to him.
Well, you might or you might not. You might simply be grateful that your child has achieved, but you might also be really
greedy and coveting in the fact that you want them to be a little bit better.
So that you're saying that there is an arrogance or the negative pride or destructive pride. There is a kind of ranking. Mm-hmm. There is a kind of an attempt to put yourself above other people. Okay.
I also see it as a guardedness. Sometimes you guard yourself with your pride so that you do not, you can't accept the fact that you failed. You know, you're so proud, or your pride is so great that a failure is just baffle you.
That's an interesting sort of whole area that we point at with pride. Can you pull that out a little bit more? There's a lot of this in some of the Greek plays about this.
I see it myself sometimes, you know, that because of the pride, that it's hard to admit that something hasn't always been perfect, or that a child has failed. Hasn't achieved.
He's too proud to admit the truth.
Yeah.
That kind of sense.
And it can really get a person into a lot of emotional torment.
That's an interesting phenomenon, because in that when you're talking about that kind of situation, you're really implying that the person knows the truth. The person knows the truth and isn't able to deal with it publicly.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's a bit of dishonesty.
In Greek plays, they wouldn't necessarily know the truth. They would simply not be able to even see that their pride is causing the fall.
Yeah, the suppression that you mentioned yesterday. Is that what I hear you saying? That the truth is there, but the person actually suppresses it from their own self-awareness.
Yeah, maybe. Actually, he triggered the thought about the Greek plays, and I was just trying to think of some. It seems to me that...
Well, maybe it's suppression, but I think even beyond that, it's total failure to even recognize.
Mm-hmm. Like in the case of a marriage.
Almost an inability, not necessarily a... Nobody's brought it up to him yet.
No, inability.
You know, what I think Yahweh wouldn't like about all of this is that it's an inner focus on ourselves instead of being concerned about others or in communication with Him.
Clearly it's a shape of consciousness, a consciousness shape, in which one of the characteristics of it is a distortion of how we look at ourselves and how we look at other people. There's something bizarre in when a person is caught up in one or another kind of pride. One of the things that happens is a distortion of how you see yourself, and this involves a distortion of how you see the community and your relationship to other people. I think it's important to note about the discussion that we've really been mentioning a number of different kinds of psychological conditions, a number of different kind of human conditions, which we point at with the word pride, but they may be quite different. They may be really quite different. There's quite a bit difference between being grateful and happy, being proud of someone who has finally achieved something, and being proud that, you know, if you make it up to Lyman Lights, you ought to be proud. It's a long hike. You know, there's quite a bit of difference between that kind of condition and that kind of reaction, and the sense of dignity which has to hide its own weaknesses. Although, again, even under some conditions, that kind of negativism, you know, it's very funny. There are all sorts of things that in good days we ought to get rid of, but that in bad days may see us through a bad spot. It's really funny. There's certain warts or sins that you really ought to work very hard to get rid of. But every once in a while, the funniest thing happens. One of those things turns out to be the thing which enables you to carry through a really messy situation. So don't be surprised if tomorrow the Lord suddenly starts dealing with you in a way that is unusual, you know, so that almost everything we want to say is true in general, but not always. But not always, because Yahweh has to live within the realm where Yahweh's voice is heard is to have to be, you have to be ready for some surprises and for some reversals, where something that is in general a cause of a lot of problems suddenly becomes something that solves some problems. But in general, this guardedness, this inability to admit to others what they already know is a kind of a wall, builds a kind of wall between yourself and yourself and yourself and other people. And then, of course, there's this whole realm of behavior where a people or persons act with a inflated picture of themselves. In some ways, the thing that I think is at least one part of what the prophet is attacking is what we might more, if we wanted to be very careful, call illusions of grandeur. The seeing of yourself as more important, better than in common vernacular is the big head. You know, the sense of that self-image which is reflected back as somehow larger and we ought to get on to the text, and then we can come back to this at the end. I've realized that one of the things that tutor the interpretations of these texts is really some of the theology of Israel. And there are two of the aspects of Israel's condition, one positive and one negative, that I think are important. because this period up until, you really don't have the pulling together. Israel isn't Orthodox yet. Orthodoxy is generally formed in times of crisis, and the canon is collected, and Israel becomes, in a sense, more codified and concise in their identity during the exile. And so we're still 150, this is about 720s, and the Judah is defeated in 585, Jerusalem is captured finally in 585, so we're still a ways away from, we're still a ways away from their particular exile and the trauma of that, so that there still is a fairly complex religious and social scene. On the one hand, they are reasonably prosperous, secure, and with the security, there is a kind of indigenous, what I want to kind of stick my neck out and call a kind of indigenous polytheism. Only some of the Israelites, some of the time, even though they confess it regularly, really live as though God were one. H. Richard Niebuhr, in this Radical Monotheism in Western Culture, talks about having plural centers of value. To have many gods is to have many things that you love equally. Your God, says Luther in the large catechism playing off of Deuteronomy, is what you fear, love, and trust more than anything else. So that if you want to get at the real God of the culture, you don't ask what they believe in, you ask what they love. If you want to see where gods are, you ask what people love. And so in a secure society with a great appreciation of wide ranges of order, you have people investing a bit of themselves here and a bit of themselves there and a bit of themselves there and a bit of themselves there. And there is no overarching criteria or unity which enables one to find priorities and enables one to sit loose to what one loves and enables one to care for what one adores and what one worships. So that there is, on the one hand then, in Israel, a syncretism, a polytheism, which is attacked in this oracle as idolatry. And we should really be realistic, I think, that polytheism is really the normal state of culture. You'd really have to say that if you looked at the religion of America structurally, you'd really have to say that we were polytheists. In other words, we say something about the unity of God, but we really have a number of centers competing for finality and absoluteness, all the way from the cults of human development, notice that the problem with idolatry is not that anything that becomes an idol is intrinsically bad. The problem with idolatry is not that anything is intrinsically destructive, but it becomes destructive when it becomes the sole, absolute, fundamental criteria of anything else, of everything else. Nothing wrong with being ambitious until ambition is the scale that sets all the priorities of human life.
Doesn't God recognize this when he says, you shall have no other gods before me?
Right. The fundamental gift with the revelation of the unity of God was to affirm an order of priorities which relativizes all human achievement. Not takes worth away from all human achievement, not negates all human achievement, but relativizes all human achievement. Not totally desacralizes human achievement, so that the creation, which in the sky god religion was the final fundamental of God's being, becomes in Yahwism something to be cared for. Sexuality, which in the fertility tradition was a fundamental revelation of sacralness, becomes something to be enjoyed and used for human community. So that this bit about idolatry, in this text, is a fairly fundamental attack on a situation where there are no priorities, and there is, without one God, there is no principle to create a consensus about priorities. So in fact, you have the society. Not simply that there is no priority for the individual, but if there is no priority for the community, then the community has no way of really achieving a sense of direction and no basis for establishing its priorities. So that these figures see idolatry or polytheism and versus monotheism, they see this tension as something that has, it's not just a theoretical matter, it's a matter that impacts the social order and the ability of the community to live up to its ideal, the Yahwistic ideal. So you have this, so in terms of backgrounds, keep these two things in mind: the natural polytheism, pluralism of the society, and the emerging insight, the revelation of the unity of God, and the transcendence of this unity, which is positing a vision of priorities and so on. And these two things are fairly locked into a sort of life-death wrestling match. Let me get on with the text. The first stanza, two things about the poetry. One is the interesting use of repetition. Will you notice that verse 11 is repeated in verse 17? The haughty look at man, looks of man shall be brought low, and the pride of men shall be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Verse 11 and verse 17. And the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the pride of men shall be brought low, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. There is a practically verbatim repetition of the verse. And verse 10 is repeated in verse 19. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the glory of his majesty. The picture is fundamentally, the picture is the destruction of the city. It, you know, how during the atomic bomb days, people were building building storm cellars and all this sort of thing, and in the old days they built hurricane cellars and this sort of thing. Well, it's that thing. You're going to go head for the caves and the hills when the armies come. So the verse 10 is repeated in verse 19. And men shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord, from the glory of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. And then verses 18 and 19 are repeated in verses 20 and 21, so that the last stanza is in fact a double repeating of the chorus, substantively. And the idol shall utterly pass away, you notice in 18, and then in 20, and that day men shall cast forth their idols. And 19, and men shall enter the caves. 21, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the hills, and so on. So that you have a very effective, one of the effects of these oracles, these prophetic poems, is that there is a very profound rhythmic chiseling away of the theme by a subtle repetition. Now, the other very strong, very, very, very strong section here is again accomplished by the repetition of a picture. The prophet picks up as a symbol of pride, as a symbol of this distortion, the big head. As a symbol of the distortion, self-distortion, the prophet picks up the picture of height, and he has an almost litany of all the tall things that they've seen. All of which then, you see, he uses all of these tall things as to reinforce how the community and persons have had their self-image blown out of, and it's a fantastic hammer list of images. Begins in 12. For the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up and high. And now come the serious. Against the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, tall trees, against the oaks of Bashan, against all the high mountains, against all the lofty hills, against every high tower. You move from all the naturally tall things to all the big things that people have built, you know, the bridges and the towers and the dams and all that sort of thing. Against every high tower, and against every fortified wall, and then you move down to the sea, you know, and these tall masts on the sailing vessels, against all the ships of Tarshish and all the beautiful craft, so that you have this fantastic kind of hammering away of building up of the vision of all these tall things, and human beings have themselves located in all these tall things, and they're worshiping all these things. You know, they've got shrines worshiping the trees, and they're worshiping their business, and they're worshiping their fortifications, and they're worshiping their watchtowers. They've got all these huge things to enjoy, and these have gotten to be the center of their existence, rather than the what they care for.
Sounds a little bit like today.
Well, you know, sometimes it's really kind of amazing that some of the things in the Bible really do sound a little. So, and this is this particular build-up here, which is very, very strong, is really accomplished by the repetition of simply a list of of tall things.
In verse 16, there's a note in the RSV that the Hebrew is uncertain. The word beautiful doesn't. Do you have another translation on that or interpretation? All the beautiful craft?
No, I don't know any more about that than the note.
New English says pleasant pictures, which is, yeah, doesn't really say anything to me.
New English has the BHOWS of Arabia. I suppose that's a term for the boats of Arabia or something like that.
Now, there are a lot of places where they just can't quite figure out. There are a few places where they can't quite figure out the text, and they cover it over in the translations. But the other one is verse 22. I don't know what to do with verse 22. It's a sermon all by itself. But it doesn't fit this whole section has a tremendous symmetry, and it just doesn't fit in. So I sort of take 22 like I take verse 5. You know, it's one of those one verse sermons. At least some. I just think that once in a while there were some one line sermons. Somebody had a really good line, and they saved the line, and they just stuck it in wherever they could. You know, and we don't ever hear hardly any one-line sermons except yesterday at Matins, so that we're not used to that possibility. But maybe there were. Okay, let's get at the progression of the text. The first stanza is verses 6 through 11, and there's something very important here. There's a very dramatic thing that happens in this section that you can just go right by and not notice. If you'll notice verses 6 through 9, the prophet is talking to Yahweh. The pronouns are thou. And the last thing in verse 9 is that the prophet or some other voice says to God, don't forgive them. They don't, you know, they don't deserve it. And then in verse 10, what's said is addressed to the people. So there's a terribly dramatic struggle, terribly dramatic thing happening to the prophet that you will miss entirely if you don't notice the pronouns. So I wanna illustrate this by when the prophet is talking to Yahweh, you can overhear, but it's not intended for you to hear directly. For thou hast rejected thy people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of diviners from the east, and of soothsayers like Philistines, and they strike hands with foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there's no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there's no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. So man is humbled, and men are brought low. Forgive them not. Enter into the rock. Pack up and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord, and from the glory of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the pride of men shall be humbled, and the Lord of alone will be exalted in that day. So, first stanza is the people sort of coming on the prophet at the altar, kind of talking it over with Yahweh. And then, after that, after the kind of arrangements have been made, the prophet addresses the people. Now the second stanza from 12 through 17 is a very lyrical recitation. Whereas in the first stanza, the prophet had told the people to do this. In the second stanza, the prophet describes it happening. And simply describes it very simply. And then in the third stanza, it's again a description of what will take place. So that he starts out by telling the people to do it, and then he sort of pictures it in two different ways happening. In the first stanza, he explains some of the reasons for it. In the second stanza, he has images of the height and the meaning of the pride. And in the third stanza, he simply describes much more in detail the consequences, causes, the impact of the pride, and consequences in the third stanza. So through the three stanzas, although there's a lot of repetition, there's a subtle movement of theme from a focus on the conditions that lead to the pride, the impact of the pride done visually, and then the consequences. We've already talked a little bit about the causes of pride, the confusion of priorities. The cult is superstitious. There isn't the kind of critical discernment. One of the functions of community and prophets and priests is to provide some kind of discernment of orders of value in the society, and this isn't being done. And the result is, and one of the most pertinent descriptions of pride is in verse 8. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. That's the great irony, that human beings will place primary value on things that they themselves have created, on things that are sort of a result of them, that they will worship not the sources of life which enable them to create and be creative. Now notice, it isn't an issue of enjoying the things. Nobody in Israel, Yahweh would enjoy what had been created. The problem is not that you can't, of course you can enjoy what you've made. The problem is the worshiping of the things that their own hands have created. And so that there's a kind of reversal, where instead of being celebrating the things which have been given and adoring the sources of givenness, you have the adoring of the given and the ignoring of the rivers and sources of life. So that's one of the most succinct sort of probing kind of descriptions of how people get into the condition of holiness. Evelyn?
Maybe you don't want to get into the first part of chapter 2, but how do you reconcile the forgive them not attitude in this, and the forgiveness and hope that you see in that earlier section, where really that he may teach us his ways and we may walk in his path? There's some hope and forgiveness in that. And here is forgive them not.
I don't reconcile them. I mean, I think we have to deal with the reason I'm not dealing with 2, 1 through 4, and we could do it another day, is that it's practically identical with a section in Micah, and is probably, it may even be from another prophet. The way I reconcile is that not every day is the same with the people of God, and not every prophet has the same message.
But this is probably not part of the original.
I think they're totally separate poems. So that in this text, you really... Now, that's pretty strong language for the prophet. And I think that there's a much greater realism here. There's a much greater realism about the anguish and humanness of the prophet than we are used to. You have also in the Psalms, you know, these sections about vengeance, and I think here again is one of the big hang-ups is that they didn't have, you know, they really thought that there were times where it was right to get angry. There were, and they really accepted the anguish of the prophet, so that Yahweh didn't always do it, but so that I think we have to get used to a somewhat different world, and admit sometimes maybe they were vindictive, and we'll have to deal with some of these things and become a different sort.
There's a cross-reference on verse 22 that sort of struck me, and it was Jeremiah 17:5. Thus saith the Lord, cursed be the man that trusteth in man. And I wondered if this wasn't the point then he's making in back in verse 9 where he says, forgive them not.
Well, it's the same idea. It is really the same idea.
His heart departed from the Lord.
Okay, I think we... I suggest that you sit down and read it through once. And because you have in a way, I think the impact of the piece, is really the thunder against this self-image that is so relentless and so undercutting. And it has to be, the piece really needs to be listened to as a whole concert.
I shouldn't ask this question now, but because it's the end, but I'm getting confused now about what pride is, if it is a worship of the extension of ourself in our works, as opposed to the kind of idea of inflating ourselves to the point of being God in the good sense of figures.
One word we didn't put up there that is in verse 17, and that's haughtiness.
If you worship an extension of yourself, that's almost a denial. That's almost a... That's a funny kind of pride.
Well, I think that's a good question, but I think we ought to think about it and let Rudy start in, because I think we maybe the point of the text is that we've got to go looking for our kind of pride.
Yeah.